company is wherever I go. I'm a hobo CEO. I'm a hobo CEO.
Business, lifestyle, and the philosophical implications of business whilst wearing shabby trousers. Or no trousers at all.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Chris Kirkland coming to you from the Hobo CEO podcast. And with me today is Nico. Hello, Nico.
Hi, Chris. I heard that you have met someone I haven't met yet and even interviewed him. So tell me all about it.
Yeah, I caught up with a gentleman called Patrick Larson, who is also a fellow DCer, and enjoyed hanging out. We had lots to talk about. And yeah, I thought, right, let's turn on a microphone and stick it in front of our faces. So we had a good old chat about the entrepreneurial mindset. If you hobos stay tuned, then you will hear that chat about entrepreneurial mindsets.
Sounds good. Have you had some background information, some context on Patrick before you jump into the interview?
I'll let Patrick explain himself in the recording, but cool. What I would say is I think he had a fairly important mindset shift recently, which has acted as a catalyst to him coming to Southeast Asia and, you know, overcoming a lot of entrepreneurial humps. So that's the background I'd like to set. It was there's a sort of fairly recent epiphany which was driving our conversation.
That sounds awesome.
Lucky to be joined by Mr. Patrick Larson, who has exploded on the scene at Ho Chi Minh City. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be here. Good to be in Ho Chi Minh. I have to admit, I'm still sweating like a newly minted expat, but it's a lot of fun to be around all the energy here.
Indeed. So let's plunge straight into today's designated conversation, which is about mindset. Let's just clarify things a bit. We're primarily focused with the entrepreneurial mindset,
yeah,
which I think is perhaps in line with other kinds of mindset to do with things which are stepping out of the norm, maybe like an artist, musician, astronaut, poker player,
yeah,
might also resonate with.
Yeah, it's just anywhere where you're very clearly taking your own fate in your hands, you're depending on your own skills, your own energy. There's a significant chance of failure. That failure has a significant chance of significantly impacting your life. And you're not interested so much in just heavy politics. It's more your internal mindset and then what actions you take.
So let me start with a question. So you've obviously had a shift fairly recently.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about how your mindset has changed as a result of that shift? What maybe you saw things before, which now you see differently, which has had a real impact?
So that major shift was what I thought about fear of failure and how it consciously or unconsciously played a role in what I thought and what I thought was in the realm of possibility, and then what I actually went and did, and then how I conduct myself once I'm, you know, doing business or meeting people, making friends in a, you know, casual or business context. So it affects everything. It's a full lens that you're wearing at all times. So when you change, you know, the tint of the lens, you change the world you see. So what it did for me, like this mindset shift that I had after doing some personal development, happened in late November. And since then, some of the more, you know, noticeable effects are that I'm on a 45-day tour through Southeast Asia, away from my wife and two little kids. That's an incredibly drastic thing for someone to do if they didn't think there's going to be a massive return on their investment per se, in terms of network, business opportunities, business skills, life skills, all those things. But I was totally willing to take that risk. And I didn't hesitate. I just knew it was something I had to do and that I was going to make it work.
So you potentially wouldn't have taken that risk before?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's an opportunity cost in income. There's the risk that once you get out to Porto Galera, Philippines, which you've never been to, and you're going to take, you know, one night in Manila and then a bus and then a ferry and trike ride to a hotel, that, you know, things can just go wrong, right? And you're in a foreign country 10,000 miles away from anyone that's remotely interested in helping you.
So what would the script in your mind been before which would have stopped you taking this trip, and what is the script now which has encouraged you to take this trip?
I probably would have done a detailed budget or something, and I would have tried to somehow quantitatively figure out who was going to be at a business or entrepreneurial workshop that I was going to attend there, and kind of like say, well, for this expense, it's not really clear how I'm going to get any income out of this. Like, I always valued friendship and network, but it's not clear to me if I would have gone on a full-on 45-day tour through the Philippines, Vietnam, and Thailand, and Portland, Oregon, with just no thought at all of not doing it.
Mm. So it sounds like before you were maybe looking for some sort of calculation of the expected return.
Yeah.
To kind of justify the 45-day expenditure.
And now I feel I'm just trying to fuel kind of an infinite growth. Like there's a hot air balloon going, and you just keep, you know, pulling, because you just keep ascending faster and faster if you just keep pulling on the whatever, the fuel lever. Not enough burn that I can figure out in life, like just full on pull it down, let it rip, go as fast as you can, as far as you can.
I'm suddenly reminded of that book about cheese. What's it called? Do you know the book? There's something about a mouse losing its cheese.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I have not read it. It's quite short, and it's like a parable. It's like not my cheese, or...
Where's the cheese?
Where's my cheese?
It's where's my cheese. My cheese or something.
Somebody who took my cheese?
Something like that. It's a parable about, like, change and responding to change.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, how, you know, a lot of it's about doing things that you haven't done before.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know... I think this sounds like a classic example of that, which perhaps your previous mindset would have been holding you back from. It's like stepping into an unknown situation where there's no obvious account, calculatable returns.
Yeah, per se. I mean, I think the world is a very safe place. I was in the military before. I was a Navy helicopter pilot. I'd been to 15 countries. I'd been on deployment for basically 2 years. I'd been in war zones, I led combat missions. So it's not ever a sense of physical risk. It's more a sense of, you know, financial risk, or the fear of making compounding bad decisions. Like, what am I doing? I should be just pursuing a corporate job. My opportunity cost of not pursuing that finance life because I have an MBA, or a corporate life because I have an MBA and, you know, a military pedigree, is somewhere between 20 and 30,000 a month. So that's significant.
Mm.
Yeah.
One key thing here is just this sort of basic animal instinctive fear of the unknown, urge for safety, desire for safety, which I think is a classic problem that humans have today. Because as you say, the world is a safe place. We're in unprecedented times where we just turn a tap and drinkable water comes out, or, you know, here we get it from a bottle. But basically the environment we're evolved for is not the environment we're in now. And the kind of instincts and fears we have don't match very well the environment we're in. And I mean, I get this myself, as I've mentioned in previous episodes. When I fly to a country that I've not been before, or take the train, I've got this animal sort of fear of the unknown. I'm a bit afraid of, oh, where do I put the money in, and how do I get the taxi, and where am I going to stay? And, it, you know, I get the same thing repeat every time I go to a new country. However, at least from experience of doing this again and again and again, it's becoming less of an issue. And actually, rationally, I know I can turn up into most countries, and within 48 hours, I'm going to feel perfectly at home and comfortable.
Yeah, I totally agree on those two things. You hear people who are hardcore travelers all the time say, you know, I need to avoid getting comfortable. I need to keep going places I've never been and trying things I've never done. And it's twofold. One is that when you go into new situations, you are hyper aware and hyper alert, and you're paying attention to details and constantly looking for danger, whether it's there or not, just because that's our basic survival instinct. You have a home base and you're very comfortable in your cave. You don't have to keep looking in every dark place in the cave. You know there's nothing there. But as soon as you go out in uncharted territory, you don't know if you're on, you know, enemy territory, if you're in, you know, the territory of some wolf pack, or, you know, if there's a cliff coming up. You don't know these things. And it's very, very practical and sensical to just be hyper alert in new places that you're unfamiliar with. And that also leads to a lot more growth when you're picking up the details, which is fantastic. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. But we're very much stuck in a tribal mindset where, you know, fear of death is the number one thing that drives our lives and our decisions. And attached to fear of death are things like fear of change and fear of the unknown. Change and the unknown can quickly lead to death. So I think it's everything is rooted in death. There is no other fear.
But this is on a kind of evolution-based, animal-based level. The life we lead now, we're not really facing death.
Very rarely.
Yeah, unless you're a search and rescue helicopter pilot.
Or you just like to drink too much in the wrong parts of town.
So you're clearly a man that has overridden a lot of these artifacts of evolution which are still left with us.
I think I can notice the situations where it just doesn't matter. Like, I can just go up and talk to a new person and I know I can be engaging and I don't have to fear rejection. And if I get rejected, I'm just totally fine with it because there's an optionality to these interactions where it's a very fixed downside, which is the loss of a bit of time. I don't incur any additional downside because I don't have like a massive serotonin dip when someone rejects me as a human being. And the upside could be just a brief friendship where I just have a nice casual conversation, but it can be massively more than that. It could be that I'm talking to a woman whose husband is a serial entrepreneur who's founded and sold 3 companies on 3 continents, and he's very interested in the entrepreneurial communities I participate in, and now I have a potential new mentor, investor, and whatnot, and here we go.
Do you think that's something that you're predisposed to? Do you think that's like your personality, or is this something that you've learned and as a result of your changes in mindset?
It's you know, with everything, it's a combination of all three. I was born an extrovert. I never had a problem talking to people. I was born with, you know, a good amount of mental and physical talent, so I was never too shy about taking on extreme challenges, like playing sports at a very high level in high school, going after, you know, admission to select universities, picking extremely demanding career paths, such as, you know, being a pilot or being an investment banker, both of which I was. And so as I did all these things, I was also building up more capability and more justified competence and more experiences that I could parlay into a nice opening conversation. If you tell me you like to travel, I can talk about that. If you tell me you like kids, I can talk about that. If you tell me you like business, I can talk about that.
So it sounds like you started with quite a high skill level.
Yeah, I believe so. I think on the vast distribution, I was to the right end.
In especially with respect to overcoming some of these limitations of evolution, where we might be afraid to approach new people and things like that.
Yeah.
So you lucky bastard.
I would have tried my damnedest to become the tribal leader.
Yeah.
100,000 years ago, that would have been the path I'd picked.
So this is somewhere where we might be able to have a little bit of a interplay because we're coming from slightly different directions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've had a mixture of both being extremely extrovert and introvert. I've had there was a period when I was younger where I had a extreme nervous reaction in certain social situations. I won an academic prize at my school, which entailed that I would have to go on stage to collect the prize.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to my teachers, I'm not going to do that. I don't go on stage. And they were like, you've got a problem, Chris. We're going to coach you through this. They kind of dragged me into this state where I was okay. It was, you know, there were 100 other people that were doing the same thing, and you're only on stage for like a split second. So they took me to the door and I walked through it, and that was that. What I've noticed in my own experience is I have a propensity to really talk myself out of doing certain behaviors, which it sounds like you have less of a propensity to. You're kind of more, you know, by default, talking to new people. You're the kind of that kid that talks to everybody.
Yeah.
And I maybe wasn't so much that kid.
If I don't consciously inhibit myself, the default path of least resistance is to just say hi.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just like everyone else. If you're just on a train with someone and you have no reason to initiate a conversation with the person next to you, you might not do so. If I didn't have a smartphone or anything, definitely. But now I try to look at someone really quickly based off two or three heuristics, see if there's an opening line I can talk about, whether it's the news, the biggest news of the day, because that person's reading an article, or where this train is headed, or the clothing, or the, you know, the age and socioeconomic status that this person is signaling, whatever.
So this is important for entrepreneurship, because making connections with people is key. Just to remind the listener why we're talking about this. All right, let me give a quick brain dump on what I do now to feign being a Patrick Larson. It's actually quite simple, you know. I've realized that, as I said earlier on, my mind kind of talks me out of certain things. So kind of the main learning is to just sort of turn that script off in my head, is to just not think about things. Over the last few years, I've set myself goals in terms of speaking to people, getting out of comfort zone and whatnot. You don't need to set huge goals. In fact, I kind of recommend against it.
Yeah.
Doing the really big shifts, I find less sustainable than just a series of smaller ones.
Mm-hmm.
Great book recommendation I'll drop in here is The Motivation Hacker, talking about success spirals, the idea of kind of setting small attainable goals, which spiral upwards. So I've kind of approached, I don't know if it's socializing the right word, but these kind of situations with this mindset of just, you know, maybe just starting with something like, I don't know, innocuous conversation, asking directions, things like this. And gradually I find it redefines who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually then starts becoming normal to do these interactions.
Yeah.
You labeled yourself as an extrovert earlier on, and maybe I was implying that I'm an introvert. I think it's a fallacy to label yourself in that way. We're malleable. There's a hell of a lot you can change. You know, from this teenager with this kind of extreme nervous disposition to public speaking to thousands of people and playing live in front of thousands of people, you know, there's a big kind of shift in what I've been capable of. So I think number one takeaway from this is don't kind of define who you are in your mind. Like, kind of scrub that out. It's a blank canvas.
Yeah, when you'd mentioned earlier that I'm a lucky bastard and I was born with this, you know, there's no denying that I do have certain beneficial, you know, initial conditions in mindset and family and environment and upbringing. But I've also been very conscious about constantly improving my skills, whatever they may be. Maybe they're technical skills, maybe they're soft skills, maybe it's my body, like in terms of just physical fitness, because they're signaling there. Self-confidence, but also what you send out to people. So there's lots of conscious steps, lots of books, lots of podcasts, lots of courses. Spent $100,000 on business school to massively improve my mind and my technical skills and my network. So there is all this conscious personal development. And now that I'm at the end of, you know, I'm in the middle of this, like I'm 33, I'm clearly in the middle of whatever life journey I have. I don't consider the productive life 100 years. I consider it 60 years, and then the rest hopefully is coasting or mentoring body painting. So I think now that I'm, you know, 33 and I've seemed to have hit on a pretty good algorithm, I can shorten that gap for other people, right? You can write this thing down. You can give an 80-20 and say, look, these three things, these five books, these five daily practices. And you can take someone who was not born with the best initial conditions, and you can get them to a very high level of comfort and competence in engaging other people and allowing these positive network effects, quite literally network effects, to start playing a bigger role in their lives.
Talking about mindset, I think a big part of it is switching off the wrong mindset more than it is switching on the right mindset. What are your thoughts?
So I love metaphor, and one thing I like to consider and ponder all the time is our bag of bricks. I think every human being carries around a certain, you know, size bag of bricks, and it makes things harder. I like to think of us as life as climbing a mountain. You can stay down in the valley, everyone's very comfortable there, but some people have wanderlust and they want to climb the next hill, or they want to climb a little mountain, and some people look at that mountain off in the distance, obscured in cloud and stormy, and they say, that's the mountain I want to climb. And they just go about climbing it, and they can climb it even holding on to that bag of bricks. But oh man, it gets a lot easier if you know there's a bag of bricks there and you can start taking bricks out, or you just put the bag of bricks down all together. And I think I've put down most of my bricks, and at this point I'm pointing out to other people that, hey, you have a bag of bricks that you probably didn't realize you'd packed, and let me start taking bricks out for you. To extend the bag of bricks metaphor, if you're in a pool of water and you're at the bottom of the pool hanging on to a bag of bricks, you're panicking, you're drowning, you can't breathe, you're suffering. You just want to breathe, and you just see no way of this suffering ever ending. Like, it seems eternal and perpetual. And if you just let go of that whole damn bag of bricks, you don't have to do anything else. You will ascend. Mm. You will be able to break the surface, and you'll breathe in big, beautiful, delicious breaths of air. And you won't be at the bottom of the pool drowning anymore if you just let go of that bag of bricks.
So let's talk about what some of those bricks could be. Stuff like toxic relationships, living somewhere you're really unhappy.
Internal scripts, hope, lack of hope.
Yeah.
Massive fear, debt.
Debt, that would be another one.
The burden of lack of education, or the burden of too much education? The burden of too much expectation, the burden of too little expectation.
Yeah, that's a big one. What your goals and aspirations are. We talked about this in a previous podcast. You can hack your self-confidence by either adjusting the level that you're at or lowering your expectations.
Yep.
So yeah, we kind of concluded that it was actually quite difficult to lower your expectations artificially. You can suddenly realize that maybe the goal you're shooting for is way too big, and actually you'd be happier with something lower, then that's a nice, easy, you know, say your peers are people working in finance, and everyone's lighting their cigars with $50, $100 bills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe kind of taking a step out of that peer group would just lift some of those bricks off of your back.
Yeah, and so there's two things here. Bricks are in real life, bricks are what they are. They are neither positive nor negative forces in this world. You can bash someone's head in with it. You can use it as a sharpening instrument. You can use it as a door jam. You can use it to build a wall, a school, an orphanage, a factory, anything. And the bag of bricks you're carrying around, like expectations, you can just flip that around. And instead of saying, the burden of my parents expecting me to be a great lawyer is crushing, instead you somehow find a way to just think, that is a worthy goal, and I shall do what it takes to achieve that. I'm so glad I have supportive parents who set good goals and have shaped the environment for me, and I'm so glad that I'm a person who is capable of attaining that. You know, perhaps I don't reach that lofty goal, but it's worth aiming for, and if I fall short of it, I'm still higher up the mountain, to mix the metaphors.
Like, that springs to my mind resistance. Resistance is a great brick to throw away.
Yep.
Just like accepting and not having strong resistance, it saves a lot of your energy. And
it just,
for my background in martial arts, Tai Chi, it seems to be a very useful metaphor in life and how things operate.
Yeah, you're looking for resistance and you're deciding what to do with it from there. The best part about all of this and the worst part about all of this is you can't do one thing all the time. There is no answer. In martial arts and jiu-jitsu, sometimes you're seeking resistance so that you can use that as leverage to toss someone over your shoulder and onto the ground. And sometimes you're trying to give massive resistance against them so they can't do the same thing to you in a different form, lowering your center of gravity. And in life, sometimes you need to seek out maximum resistance. And I said, I'm 17, I'm pretty capable, I'm bored out of my mind. What's the biggest challenge I can think of? Well, it seems like getting into the Air Force Academy, being a fighter pilot, parlaying that into being a USN or an astronaut is a pretty tough path. Okay. And I didn't even consider the odds, which were 7% acceptance rate. Didn't even consider it.
There's this classic story about what was it, some tunnel in the States. I forget the exact statistics and where the tunnel was, but it was estimated to cost $1 million to build this tunnel, which would have really increased the trade routes and the, you know, made the, these two areas prosper much better by being, building this tunnel through this mountain. Halfway through, they realized the mountain's full of granite and it's gonna cost $10 million. So they're halfway through, they're already in the tunnel and it's gonna cost 10 times what they thought it was, but they're already halfway there. They're committed, they've got no choice but to finish this tunnel. And the net result is very positive. You know, these two regions flourish as a result.
Mm-hmm.
Had they known in advance that the actual cost was 10 times what they thought it was, they wouldn't have started.
No one ever does.
However, yeah. because they either didn't consider the cost or it was lower than what it was, they did embark upon the journey. And that's the classic tale of the entrepreneur, you know, the dumb entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of, or she, is not aware of the risks or the low chances of success. So they continue with this abandoned confidence. And when they're halfway through the tunnel, they've got no choice but to continue.
Yeah, if you know, certainly you talk to lots of entrepreneurs who have made it through the other, and maybe after 3 years, maybe after 30 years, and they say, in retrospect, I never would have embarked on this life. It was too hard. If you told me at the beginning what I was going to have to do and the sacrifices, I surely would not have done it.
Yeah.
But they're generally quite glad that they did do it in the end. And it doesn't much matter. They did it. The arrow of time doesn't appear to work that way. Yeah. So who cares?
There's a big reframe I have on what success and what one should look for in life. And it's not it's like financial numbers or status or wealth or whatever. It's how much work you've done on yourself and mm-hmm. how you've responded to the challenges in life. And when you kind of measure your success in those terms, like being poor at 45 or being kind of bankrupt or whatever, it gives you access to more of these challenges. It gives you a chance to kind of test and grow and like better yourself. This is actually a great reason to be unrealistic and to be overconfident and take on things which you maybe have little chance of succeeding in, because it exposes you to all these opportunities of improving yourself.
To go back to the mountain metaphor, if you pick that mountain, it could be a medium-sized one, it can be a large one, it can be the massive one obscured in cloud. You know that if you commit to it, probably at the start, you're not quite ready. You don't have the lung capacity, you don't have the lungs, you don't have the legs, and you don't know the path. You can't look at the tip and see every step you're gonna take. But if you commit every day to making progress, if you commit every day to taking your care of yourself such that you're stronger the next day or no weaker, and you look around a bit, you look for storms, you look for, you know, danger areas, avalanche areas, you know, drop-offs, you pay attention, you're aware. And hopefully other people are climbing that mountain and they're a little ahead of you and you can follow their steps. Or you just take courage in the fact that, you know, in the middle of the night, you see their light. You know, one day's climb ahead of you, so you know it's possible to get one day more up the mountain. And if you fall, you fall forward, you fall up, and each day you've ascended. Even if it feels like failure, even if you're sore, even if you had to backtrack for 2 days, your legs got stronger, your lungs got stronger, your confidence in yourself is higher. But you generally need to fully commit to climbing that damn mountain. When I decided to go to the Air Force Academy, at first they told me, oh, you can't get in this year, we'll send you to a preparatory school, and then next year you'll get to go in. And the dates that, you know, time was dragging on, I'd gotten accepted to other good universities like UCLA, which was one of the top 20 universities in the United States. That was my fallback, you know? And the date went by where I had a scholarship to UCLA. And I said, well, it's very apparent that I'm fully committed to the Air Force Academy this year or next year. There just wasn't a way I was going to fail at this. And my failure mode was full scholarship at UCLA. I'd worked very hard to get there. I was a very diligent student, and so I earned it. But should you aim at something lofty but attainable, like a $10 million business that you only have to work a maximum of 20 hours a week in 5 years, and you don't attain that, but you're doing all the things required that you think will be required to achieve that, meeting all the right people, putting in all the right business systems, reading all the right stuff, hiring the right people with the right process, happening on the right business model, participating in the correct macroeconomic trends. What's your failure mode? It could be complete bankruptcy, but even if it's complete bankruptcy, you surely would have learned something in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And if it's something lower than $10 million, great. And then there's a possibility of it far exceeding $10 million.
Mm.
So if that's the mountain you pick to climb, climb hard.
Yeah.
You get to define your failure just like you get to define your successes. And so things like, oh, I only made $3 million, doesn't have to be failure, even though you set an initial condition of $10 million, or I only grabbed one incredible person to be my mentor this year, not the six that I'd set out for.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a long game. So as I'm out here, and I was talking to a friend of mine who's a University of Chicago MBA graduate, who's in Hong Kong working for an international finance company, and he's pitching countries on letting him manage $10 billion of sovereign wealth and massively de-risking their transactions. That's his thing. He pointed out that I'm defining failure in a massively different way than most, because my fallback is amazing, beautiful wife, incredible, awesome sons, health, youth, intelligence, and greater experience.
Yeah.
So no matter what I do, you know, my fallback is go teach English or tutor to rich Asians, build up some more savings, and hit it again as a full-time entrepreneur, or 20 hours a week doing the side hustle where we live perfectly well with a two-bedroom and a scooter and a chef and a grocer and a maid.
In Ho Chi Minh City.
And the other 100 hours a week of my time I can commit to my business.
This is key. This is key, really kind of redefining what your lowest common denominator is and how good a outcome that is. Because as I was saying earlier, we have these sort of evolutionary programmed fears which aren't really relevant to our environment anymore, where it doesn't really have any tangible danger and the pitfalls are just very, very small. Even if you had to reset and you had to go back to teaching English or something, you know, you'd buy yourself some time to kind of build up and try your next idea.
Yeah, and I'd be 35 years old with a fun 5-year-old, 3-year-old, a 33-year-old wife living in Southeast Asia, traveling all the time because airline tickets are $100. Like, what, eating, you know, drinking coconuts with bearded eccentrics. Yeah, so that's the thing. Once again, back to how we define ourselves and how we define success and failure. We're physical beings. We're physical animals. We have 4 billion years of evolution in a physical world. And only in the last 1,000,000, 2,000,000, 100,000, 10,000 years have we become highly evolved social animals with this massive construct of an entire world in our head, an entire self-image and social order that needs to be maintained. And as such, we can accept physical failure very readily. You can go to the gym and you can attempt to pick up a very heavy weight and you can fail at that. And you can give high fives and say, that was awesome. Did you see that? Did you see how hard I attempted to lift that heavy weight and I failed? I just got stronger. Pretty soon I'm going to be able to lift that weight. This feels good. Endorphin release. Whereas in the social context, we do not have that 4 billion years of evolution to handle social failure, which is what business failure is. It's, oh, I attempted something, I failed at it, my standing is reduced, and now that reduced standing can lead to death. Mm. And what people do when they're afraid of death is oftentimes when they have business success, they kill themselves.
Yeah.
They commit suicide because they just lost $10,000. You can't make $10,000 back, you know, because the lack of endorphins, the turning off of that serotonin switch feels like death. It's like a heroin addict having to go through withdrawal. It feels awful. Our brains aren't set up for it on a biochemical level, on a meta-social level, anything. None of it's equipped. And that's why when you break up with someone that you're in love with, you are despondent, incredibly despondent. Whereas if you just look around and take an honest assessment, whoever you are, there's probably a couple 100,000 people in this world that you could fall instantly in love with. And if you just searched for them, you'd bump into them, and you could just start another relationship. That scarcity mentality in a tribe where there's only so many women of eligible, you know, birthing and mating. If you lose one and all the others are taken, well, you're not going to perpetuate your line anymore. That's a big deal.
But that's not the environment we're in now.
Massively different environment that we're in now.
We're essentially these primitive little machines which have this kind of program running, which isn't really correct for the environment we're in anymore. That's a key part of my mindset. I'm always kind of looking at this little primitive machine and like just checking where it's kind of off course or pointing in the wrong direction, or maybe permanently fixed in the wrong direction, and just making allowances as a result of that.
Yeah, sometimes it's updating software, and sometimes it's factory mods, right?
Yeah.
So,
or just like kind of batting it back on course every 10 meters.
Yeah. As a helicopter pilot, I didn't get to decide exactly what was going to happen. And as a rescue helicopter pilot, I got a call that said, go here. I didn't even get to plan for it ahead of time. I had to constantly train in such a fashion that regardless of the mission, first of all, right off the bat, I decide whether it's worth the risk of even taking off to attempt a rescue. And then the entire time we're flying, we're trying to gather more information, do more updates, verify, check, falsify, and make decisions on the fly, quite literally, about life and death, all the while to the rescue and then on the way back, as you may have to fight your way out as well. So that whole time, you cannot pretend that you have a plan, and you cannot assign any value or wanting to things going according to plan. You can only be in the moment. You can only be taking in information and continually setting a new course. Oh, I'm supposed to be at 500 feet. I'm at 490 feet. Guess I'll come back up to 500 feet. Oh, I'm supposed to be going true north. I'm 5 degrees off of that. I guess I'll come back. You're constantly adjusting course, which is the true answer to how you get through life. You can't live your life 10 years at a time. You have to live it one nanosecond at a time, and there's no other pace. There's no other possible pace.
One thing I've always done since I was quite young was strive to ignore peer pressure and actually sort of spit in the face of it. I'd often be the weird one. And
shocking.
I think anyone that knows me probably won't be surprised to hear that. I noticed how kind of powerful and dumb the influence of peers can be. There's that classic adage, if a million people think the wrong thing, it's still wrong. But instinctively, because we're such social animals, if a million people say something, we're so under so much pressure to at least on the face of it agree with them.
Yeah. Social proof or power, like the emperor has no clothes, is the exact same thing, but with the fear of the one instead of the fear of the many.
Mm. So I think this is a key thing, especially if you're being an entrepreneur, because, you're stepping out into the unknown. You're doing something that is against the default script of safety, security, pensions, and whatnot. So you're not going to get approval from your original peer group or your parents unless you're very lucky. So I think being comfortable with doing what's different from the Joneses, what's different from your fellows, your peers, is a really key thing.
So here's another one, which is your failures make you stronger, your enemies make you stronger, and the people who resist you or the people who create stress in your life can make you stronger. And I call that the metaphor of the samurai sword, where most people you can't take the pounding, especially if you're born into very difficult conditions. If most people that are born in those situations out of 10,000, they're all just broken people. But there's one person who took that pounding, who took the hammering, who took the fire and the ice and became a samurai sword from it, a katana blade that is fashioned almost purposefully. And it has intent, it has focus, it has an edge, and it has, a beauty and its polish. And then it is massively flexible. The thing that people forget about samurai swords is that you can bend the tip down to the base and it'll spring back to form. And that's what makes it useful, not so much the strength or the edge, but the fact that it is infinitely reliable in battle. It will not fail you. And that is what these people are in business and life and entrepreneurship. These samurai swords can just plow through the hardship, and they can adjust, and they can take the pounding, and they're stronger, and they can find more polish, and they can restore their edge.
Let me clarify this metaphor a bit. The samurai sword is something that's gone through many, many generations of evolution,
mm-hmm.
failure on the battlefield,
mm-hmm.
Different generations, their samurai swords are not working out.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's very anti-fragile and has been distilled over generations.
Yeah, same thing with piloting. The way I was taught to fly, which was only 90 years of flying, is that every time there was a mistake, the pilots died. And then the other pilots had to go see what happened and figure out, how do we survive better in this environment? How do we win better in this environment? And so there's a massive evolutionary pressure to get better, because failure comes so quickly and it comes so absolutely. You learn to have some humility. You can just shout at somebody, that is wrong. Don't you ever do that again. And I'll tell you exactly why it's wrong, because of this and that. And you have to learn some habit patterns where your hands just fly. It's just your feet are going, your hands are going, your eyes are going, your spine is going, and there's no conscious thought happening. And then at some point in your algorithm, a half second to 3 seconds in, there's an interrupt in your emergency procedure where you check things consciously, and then you go along a decision tree based off that cognition, and then your hands fly again for a couple seconds. That's how you have the best chance of staying alive. My parents were massively against me joining the military. They had considered, like, maybe not signing the papers that would let me join as a minor, as a 17-year-old, and there would have been massive consequences. And as an 18-year-old, I assure you, I still would have gone into the military. And I assure you that my parents would not have had a say in anything afterward. And I've made things harder than they need to be. There were points where, when I went to business school, it was purely for the intention of getting rich as fast as possible so I could opt out of this rat race that I felt was stupid and disgusting. And it was just, how do I pick a path where I can get really rich by age 36, 37, garner, $3 million of cash, which gives me a cash flow of $100,000 in secured, bonds, and then I'm done. And that obviously didn't lead to good things. I went into investment banking and hated it, and I basically got laid off or got fired after 1 year. I had a plan to stay in for two.
So let me take us back from the samurai metaphor to this is the thing that I remember you said the other day, and it's come up in the Motivation Hacker. It is setting your goals on what you're doing rather than what you're achieving.
Yeah.
Like saying, I'm going to work out for 20 minutes every day, 5 days a week for the next 10 years. Or I'm going to do 1 hour of reading every Sunday, rather than I'm going to achieve X, I'm going to achieve Y. I think that that's a really key realization I've had recently. It's just defining your progress by your actions rather than what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, there's a fantastic book called The Art of Power by Thich Nhat Hanh, H-A-N-H, and he is a Vietnamese Buddhist monk who was large, a big player in the peace movement in the 60s and 70s, and was expelled by the communists and had to live in Paris afterward. And he writes about being purposeful, being mindful, and living your life in a state of being. So if you set a goal of, I want to own a $5 million yacht in 5 years, and you hit that goal, you'll have a massive sugar rush on the day you achieve that $5 million yacht. And the next day, you'll have a crisis in your life as you have no other goal that is driving and motivating you. That's the midlife crisis. So instead, what you can say is, you can build in daily goals, daily practices, and then monthly and annual goals and practices that achieve certain states of being, of meditation, relationship nurturing, reflection on self, reflection on business. And if you naturally do these things that make you mindful and present and active, good things will happen. You'll be consciously taking bricks out of your bag while you're at the bottom of the pool, clutching onto that bag of bricks, and you'll ascend.
It's like building a long-term, unmovable sense of well-being versus the sugar rush of reaching peaks.
Yeah. So kind of what led me to my personal catharsis was 10 years of introspection, reading business books, reading biographies of great people, and philosophy. I'm massively a stoic person. I'm becoming much more a Zen person. I'm looking at Buddhism because I think that's the best way for me to achieve Zen, but it's all just Zen. So these failures I was talking about, with getting laid off from investment banking, having a medical device startup burn down around me, and just be left there in March of 2011 with a young boy, a wife, and no career. And finally, I got to this point, Sunday morning, November 27th, 2013, I went to Buddhist temple with my wife, and we sat down for guided meditation, and the person across from me told me that I know myself very well, and I should seek to continue to know myself well. And in that understanding of myself, I will be able to understand others better. And that's what I should aspire to. That's my path. And as we were driving home, I didn't even remember that. I had to ask my wife what that guided meditation person said to me and send me an email. So
you got your wife to send you an email.
Yeah.
So you would remember.
So that I'd be self-actualized. And then we got home, and I asked her to go out for the evening or for the afternoon and take the kids so that I could sit down with a blank white piece of paper and work through a mindset module that I'd purchased. And as I'm going through this module, and I'm looking at abundance mentality versus scarcity mentality, and then I get to this coach, and his name is Rob Scott. No, 1B, 2Ts, robscott.com, and he's excellent. You know, 20 minutes of video and some worksheets, I get myself to where I confront my fear of failure. I've never had a fear of death. It has not inhibited or played a role in any of my decisions for some reason, but I still had a fear of failure. Even though I think that the fear of death is the root cause, you know, I was somehow not connecting these. And I listed out all the things that I was afraid I was failing at and what the consequences of that failure were. And I was afraid that I would never be a good entrepreneur. And I was afraid that I would let down my parents, who are 71 and living on very fixed income. I was afraid that I was let down my wife and my kids. I was never going to live up to my personal expectations. I was going to leave all this potential out there, you know, unrealized. All of that. I was worried that I was an incomplete person and that I was fundamentally flawed and greedy and that I was never going to figure out what it took. I was lacking something and I would never get that something so that I could become a success. And so I would just have to be in a corporation. I would have to be unhappy and have to have a picture on the desk of my wife and kids and just eat shit every day for 40 years. Felt awful. And then I asked for more of that feeling for myself. I said, I want to feel more of this fear of failure. I want more ass around my heart. And I let it get as intense as it could. And then in that moment, I became present. And I just straightened my back, closed my eyes, belly breathed and curled my toes, and the fear goes away. And what's left is me. And I'm a boulder in a river, and sometimes it rages and sometimes it's calm, but the fear is gone. I'm there, very solid. And then as I become unpresent, as I let my shoulders slump and I open my eyes and I uncurl my toes and I shallow my breathing, the fear comes back, but it's less. It's still ridiculously caustic and horrible. And then I just play with that and I become present and I bring it back and I become present and I bring it back. And as I'm there, I realize that I am not my fear. I am at some base level of contentment. I am somewhere up the mountain. Mm. And as I let go of that fear, it's not me and I can play with it. I am clearly in control of my fear. I cannot tell myself that I am not in control of my fear if I can make it go away and come back at will, in a moment, in an instant. So now I sit with that and I think, okay, what are the opposite of fears? They are, you know, what is the opposite of the fear of failure? Failure, failure, it is success. And so, am I a successful person? Yes, I am. I'm 33 at this point. Yeah, I'm 33. And I have this long list of accomplishments that anyone else would envy. So I list them out and I start immersing myself in these experiences. Getting into the Air Force Academy, finishing first in my major, getting a spot in the Navy versus 50 other people that wanted to get into the Navy from the Air Force Academy. You know, I felt that moment of graduation with jets flying over my head, sun on the left side of my face, patent leather shoes, you know, thick military uniform, hugging my parents and magnifying how good that felt. And just the happiness was just like an aura around my head, just like a crown of light going out. And then become present, close your eyes, straighten your posture, belly breathe, curl your toes. And the happiness goes away. It goes somewhere else and you're your contentment. And then I play with each of my successes that way. I go through all my big successes in life. And I'm not my happiness, and I'm not my fear, and I control both of them. I'm my base level of contentment. I'm somewhere on the mountain, higher than everyone else, and I intend to, you know, go higher still. So now that I have that, I basically have a script of affirmations that are exactly counter to my fears. So instead of, I am incomplete, I am flawed, I say, I am not incomplete, I am not flawed, I have everything I need to be a success. I don't know what I should do becomes, I cannot fail if I never quit. I am someone who sees things through the end, but I'm also someone who can adjust. I can find the right people to give me the right advice. I can learn what I need to learn. I can deal with setbacks and keep pushing forward until I hit my goal. I can change my goal, but I will be a success. I am success. And that was the new personal identity I slammed into place. And personal identities are massively powerful. If you go in with some sort of psychosis, the doctor, the psychiatrist will try to identify what your current identity is and then how do they replace that with a new identity. If you say, I am depressed, then your identity is I'm someone who's depressed and unhappy, and they try to figure out a way to get you to a point where you think, I am a happy person. That's all there is to psychiatry. I'm an addict because I am a recovering addict, or I'm a reformed addict. That's how you change who you think you are. You can't give a person a script to become healthy if they're obese. But if you give them that personal identity of, I am an athlete, what do athletes do? They wake up early. I guess I'm waking up early. What do athletes do? They drink water instead of soda. I guess I'm drinking water. What do athletes do? They find running fun in groups. So I guess that's what I'm going to do. And all of a sudden, you're a fit person because you slammed in that new identity. I put in identity of success.
So that's a great personal story, which ties in a lot of our topics we've mentioned today. It's great getting to that point of presence. I love trumpeting the idea of regular meditation, you know, being in touch with what's beyond just your monkey mind, which is talking and creating these scripts, which is I am a failure or I am a success or whatever. Just learning to kind of step away from both of those. I think on that note, that's a very good point to end our conversation today. And it's also dark. The lights slowly faded out. We sat here in darkness.
And we have a lovely bunch of coconuts in the freezer waiting for us because we're in Ho Chi Minh City. And I've been transfixed by a Virgin Mary statue 50 meters away, surrounded in flashing Christmas lights. So this is the beautiful world of living in.
It's going to be awesome. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Chris.
Happiness hacks, hiring, hovering, lunching, launching, morality, morons, pipe dreams, protons, hunting, leaping, jumping, kite surfing, landing pages, optimization, and superheroes.
Another amazing Podcast Magic production.